Hello, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 FM. We are housed or located in Placitas, New Mexico, in the high desert in between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And if any of you are wondering why I'm telling that, you're going, I know where we are, Matthew. But KUPR.org streams the station. So if you are on the road and you're spending the night out of our broadcast area, just go to KUPR.org and you'll be able to continue to listen to this wonderful station. So with that said, today's show on Conversations, I am sitting down with Drew Henry, the pastor of the Placitas Presbyterian Church. And I'm going to learn a whole bunch of stuff because I don't know anything about Drew, and hopefully it's things you'll find interesting also. So welcome, Drew.
Thank you.
We always appreciate you taking time, or anyone taking time out of their day to share with us, because as you know, it's a really interesting, tight community most of the time. It's always interesting. It's tight.
Right.
And there are, you probably have found out more than most, the incredible diversity of people and personalities and backgrounds. So did you know from that aspect, did you know what you were getting into when you decided to join the congregation?
I had a sense. I came out here in 2010 for the first time to interview. They had asked me to consider moving to this community, and did my homework and got to know the congregation a bit in that process, but it's obviously unfolded over the last 6 years as I've gotten into deeper relationship and getting to know the community. But it is an incredibly diverse community with a deep historic root.
Is the connection with the Hispanic culture because of the work you had been doing for many years and where you studied,
right?
Was that a major appeal?
Well, that was part of the appeal. The church asked me, were interested in me coming. The congregation started in the late 1890s and was a Spanish-speaking congregation until the 1960s. And they had not had a bilingual pastor since that time, and they were interested in maintaining and strengthening that part of their heritage. And since I had studied and gone to my graduate work in Latin America and was fluent in Spanish, that was a piece of what brought me here. And my interest in the congregation and their interest in me. So.
Were you bilingual before you went to do your studies?
I was not. I often say I found I had a gift for Spanish that I didn't know I had. So I had done some undergraduate work in mm-hmm. Spanish, but went to Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Right.
And worked there. I went for what I thought was going to be a year, and often say it was the longest year of my life. I came back 7 years later. And loved it.
And with a whole different education.
Whole different education. My wife, who's from Buenos Aires, likes to remind me that she was the main reason I stayed, and that's fair. Did all my graduate theological work in Buenos Aires.
And you said that you found that you had an affinity for Spanish, but you were not totally fluent when you went there.
Right.
And knowing that you were going to be studying there, that's either very bold or confident or foolish. You know, I guess all three could apply.
A bit of all those things.
I would be frightened.
I didn't know I was going to do my graduate work when I went. I went as a mission volunteer with the Presbyterian Church and worked in a pastoral ministry with men and women who are homeless in downtown Buenos Aires.
Okay.
And was going to be there for a year, and then was asked to stay a second year, and found out about the seminary, Isadet, that was in Buenos Aires that I was not familiar with at all, and decided to try to take a few courses, and did it on the front end, just two courses, to see if I could do the Spanish.
Certainly.
And found I could. So
was the institution, were they kind, or were they accommodating, or it's like, we're not going to give you any leeway because this isn't your native tongue?
No, they were very accommodating. On the front end, I audited my first two courses just to see if I could do the work.
Right.
And there was a heavy learning curve to learn to do graduate work. I'd been working with folks in the streets, and that's a whole different Spanish than what you speak in the academy.
That's so. Probably what I think that's what I'm familiar with.
Right. So
the Did it make a difference because it was more of the humanities as opposed to nuclear physics? Would that have made it a bigger challenge?
You know, I don't think so. It was interesting. Any field of study has its own vocabulary, and theological studies has a very precise vocabulary also in Spanish, which I was not familiar with and not learned any of that. So I think I would have had to have learned a particular vocabulary had it been nuclear physics or theology. So.
True. At this point, do you accept, I don't know if it's urban legend, that English is the hardest language to learn if you were not a native?
English is difficult for the pronunciation, mm-hmm. but our grammar is a lot easier than Spanish. The conjugation of verbs and whatnot is a lot more complicated than English.
French is enough to drive you to drink. Right. I remember having a book on verbs. Right. I never had a book on verbs when I learned English.
Right.
But, well,
I am Presbyterian. I was working in the Anglican Cathedral, working with Roman Catholics, and going to an interdenominational seminary with seven different Protestant tradition, so Lutherans, Methodists, Valdensians, Dutch Reformed, Presbyterians. So there was a deep cross section, and yeah, and a heavily Roman Catholic culture.
But you said seven Presbyterian
Protestant,
because Placidus is, as we've discussed, diverse.
Right.
Is it overkill to do a little religion 101? No. Because I mean, I hear my whole life, you know, Presbyterian, Unitarian, Episcopalian.
Sure.
I know I have a general idea, but
I think in my mind, a lot of those traditions are as much of cultural traditions as they are religious traditions. We wrap a lot of our cultural heritage in religious language, but the Presbyterian Church comes from the Church of Scotland. So that's the roots of the Presbyterian Church. The Episcopal Church comes out of the Church of England, and after the Revolution, when the Church of England wanted to name the bishops in the United States, the church here said, no, you don't have that right to name our bishops. Episcopos in Greek is the word for bishop, so they became the Episcopal Church because they wanted to name their own bishops. The Methodist Church comes out of the Anglican tradition, which was the Episcopal Church here, so that's a break off of that. Obviously, Dutch Reformed Church comes out of the Dutch tradition. So the Lutheran Church has largely a German tradition, though not uniquely that. In Argentina, it was interesting, these church traditions also carried heritage and cultural traditions. It's much more apparent in that context because a lot of these churches in a Spanish language context had maintained their cultural heritages in a way. Today, if you walked in a Lutheran church in Albuquerque, you might not know that it had a German background. Although, mm-hmm. as you get to know, if you knew Martin Luther, you know that. But in terms of the heritage and tradition, so a lot of those places, and obviously the Roman Catholic Church comes out of, you know, a deeply Roman Italian tradition, you know, widespread around the world. Argentina's largely Roman Catholic, and I worked in this pastoral ministry with men and women who were homeless. There were 40 congregations that worked together to provide comprehensive social services to the adult homeless population in Buenos Aires, and 38 of those parishes were Roman Catholic, one Methodist and one Anglican church where I worked. So I worked mostly with Roman Catholics.
And did I miss, or did you not say the Baptists?
The Baptist is an Anabaptist tradition that comes out of also a German type of root. And then you've got different types of their congregational traditions, which the Baptists are a congregational tradition. Then you have Episcopal systems, which are bishop. So the Catholic Church has an Episcopal system. The Anglican Church has an Episcopal system. The Lutheran Church, the Methodist Church. The Presbyterians, Scots, believe in a more horizontal type of government. And so we're in between those two. We're neither congregational or Episcopal. We talk about a connectional system. So the churches, Scots have a great distrust of authority. So I always say
I saw Braveheart.
I always say I love being a pastor in a tradition that has a great distrust of clergy. So.
And which was the branch that the King of England wanted a divorce, and the papacy said, no, you can't, so he kind of started
the Anglican Church.
That's the Anglican.
The Church of England, yeah.
That always struck me as, if you are Christian and you accept the origins of Christianity, starting a branch to get a divorce seems so far afield of the whole Jesus thing.
Right. Well, and that's
and people
that's,
went along with it.
That's a piece of the story. There's never the whole story is that simple, right? And so part of the story is told also that when the King of England, France is largely Roman Catholic, and when they sent emissaries from Rome to speak with the King of England said, cross the channel and come talk to us here. And they said, no, we're here in France. You cross the channel and come talk to us over on this side. So there's also cultural pieces that come to play. Right. It's not just a divorce.
And this intense, in-depth knowledge that you have, just you know, in these few minutes, this is part of what an education in seminary is?
It is, and particularly having the opportunity to study in an interdenominational seminary. I was, my classmates were from all these different traditions, so I learned a lot about different church traditions that you might not get if you went to a seminary that didn't have that interdenominational component. So,
In the pastor world,
right?
You know, when you are going to career.com or whatever, looking for a job, or someone's posting.
Sure.
I don't know how they recruit, probably
right.
Through the church hierarchy. But is it, we want our doctor to be from Harvard. We don't want him to be from Yale. Or we want, you know, is there that kind of a distinction of which seminary you went to as to which has more cachet or which actually is a better education?
In some extents, I think it often is geographical. In the church world, many times churches in a certain part of the country will send their candidates for ministry to a seminary that's regional in nature. So Princeton Seminary is a longtime Presbyterian seminary, obviously in the Northeast. Union Seminary is in Richmond, Virginia. You have Louisville Presbyterian Seminary. There's one in Pittsburgh. Presbyterians have a deep...
Is there one in Maui?
I do not believe so.
Oh,
that
well,
would be nice, wouldn't it? There's one in Marin in San Francisco. So
that's not enough to have me change faiths at this stage of the game. Where were you born?
In the hospital. Selma, well, Alabama.
Oh.
Famous place. So.
Well, and you speak English so well.
Thank you. Thank you.
I did.
I was born and raised.
How far is that from Birmingham?
An hour and a half. That's
okay.
Where I was in ministry in Birmingham before I came to Placitas.
Same kind of culture. It's not far enough away that it be different.
Birmingham's quite different than Selma. Urban and, you know, it's obviously both... Alabama, but some pretty different realities from Black Belt. Selma is in a rural area in west central Alabama in the Black Belt. I was ready to get out of Selma when I left the first time. I did all of my family's still there. I grew up there, and I've come to really appreciate being from Selma. I was born in 1971, often say in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, and being a white man from Selma, Alabama, carried all types of prejudices.
It could be dangerous.
Well, honestly, given what the danger that a lot of folks faced in Selma, my life was very comfortable related to the danger that a lot of had faced.
Right.
But people assume that... that I had certain attitudes in relation to race that I didn't share with them, and I was ready for to move beyond that. I stayed in the South. I went to Memphis, Tennessee, did my undergraduate work there, and then after some time out west, I lived in Colorado for a little bit, and then I went to Argentina. So, but I was ready to leave. I wanted something more, but as I've come back around to that, I ended up in Birmingham. I didn't think I was ever going back to Alabama. Both of my boys were born in Birmingham, and
many of us have said we're never going back home. I think.
Yeah, I learned from my mom early on, never say never. So, don't ever say you're not going back someplace. And we loved Birmingham. It's a wonderful city, and still is. It's a bit
family and
And it's a bit of a hidden gem. People don't. I think people in Birmingham like it that not many people know how good of a city it is.
Right.
Because it keeps.
Well, it's pretty.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really very beautiful. Historic.
Right.
But from Selma, how did you end up in Argentina? Was it like on the back of the automobile ads in the newspaper? Come to Argentina, become a minister.
I grew up in the Presbyterian Church in Selma, and at that time, and I'd gone to a Presbyterian college, Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, And the Presbyterian Church on a national level was starting a program called the Young Adult Volunteer Program, and they had just begun that. And I'd like to tell the story, honestly, when they called and said, and I'd put in an application for mission service to the church, and they called and said, we're doing this new program, the Young Adult Volunteer Program, and we're going to send some people to Buenos Aires next year. And I pulled out an atlas. I didn't even know where Buenos Aires was. I knew South America. I knew Argentina's down south, but I didn't know the southern cone of South America. And so
it really is a surprising little sliver.
Oh, it is. It's an incredible part of the world. I loved living in Buenos Aires.
Why did they get the entire coast?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the Andes divide Chile and Argentina.
So. Well, that will do it. Yeah. See, I know geography too.
Yeah.
Did you get to travel a lot when you were down there?
I traveled some. I was on a shoestring budget and then graduate school. So I traveled around the southern cone a bit. I was able to travel in Argentina quite a bit and then into Uruguay, which is a bit of an unknown country for most of us in this part of the world. And it's a wonderful place. And I traveled into Chile also, so mostly in the southern cone.
Did your family have a long history? Was the church very much a part of your upbringing?
It has been. It has been. So my paternal grandmother's family was Presbyterian, and in the northern part of Dallas County, Alabama, which the Appalachian chain, people don't think about the Appalachian Mountains in Alabama, but it actually ends in northern Alabama. And the Scots, long story, but with all the political and turmoil in Scotland, then were moved over. Many left Scotland and went over into Ulster, Northern Ireland. And then there was a huge immigration from what we called the Scotch-Irish, but that came out of Ulster and a lot into Philadelphia, and then moved down the wagon trail into the Appalachian Mountains and then worked their way down Appalachia. And so that would have been, so that's the Church of Scotland, and there's the Presbyterian tradition. You can hear it in the music. Think about the music of the Appalachian Mountains and the fiddle playing and all those pieces of the musical history. That those folks couldn't carry anything else with them, but they could carry their music and their faith traditions.
And their oral traditions.
Right, yeah. Right.
So mom and dad are sisters, brothers?
Yes, I have two brothers and a sister who both live in Selma. No.
And did you come home and announce, I'm going to be, a pastor?
No, I'd been involved in the church for a long time, and I never saw myself actually being a parish pastor early on. I was interested in, felt a sense of call and vocation, and again, I worked mostly in Argentina. I worked in it was in a congregational context, but I was in this ministry with men and women who were homeless, and actually ended up dabbling in journalism a bit with them. We did a homeless street paper in Buenos Aires, and I really thought I might be doing something related to the church, but not necessarily in a parish context. But then was called to the First Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, and it was a wonderful opportunity and a great congregation, and really loved, found a love for the parish ministry that didn't know I had that either.
So there is the, I don't know, the Supreme Court of the Presbyterian Church, or not that they're judges, but is there a hierarchy? Is there a management that keeps track of all Presbyterian churches all over?
There are national organizations. The General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church is the highest council. I've just come back from General Assembly the last 10 days in Portland, Oregon. We meet every 2 years. I was the commissioner, who's the elected representative. Teaching elder is our term for a minister. So I was the teaching elder commissioner from the Presbytery of Santa Fe, which are all the Presbyterian churches in northern New Mexico. And so commissioners, elected representatives, both lay and ordained clergy go, and Presbyterians do government horizontally, and so it's the voice of the people together. And we do have elected officials in the church, a stated clerk and moderators and those positions.
But what's the agenda when you go to a big national conference on that? It's like, I want four pleats on my robe instead of three.
Yeah. One of the biggest things we did this last General Assembly, there is a confession. The Protestant Church is a confessional tradition. We have adopted confessions from different times in the life of the Church, going back to the Apostles and the Nicene Creed. And the most recent one that we just adopted this past week is the Belhar Confession, which is a confession that came out of apartheid South Africa, written out of the Black Church, speaking for unity over and above diversity as a Christian principle of faith. And long process in the Presbyterian Church to adopt a confession, but the last step was taken this past week. And so now the Presbyterian Church USA has adopted the Confession of Belhar as part of its confessional set of creeds. And one of the authors of the, Alan Bosack, is a South African Black pastor who was one of the authors of the Belhar Confession, and he was there at the General Assembly, and it was so moving to hear him expressing his gratitude to the Presbyterian Church for adopting the Belhar Confession. So it's much more than pleats.
Right.
And I think given where we are in our culture, both in the United States and around the world, in such a divisive time that we live in, for the church to be making statements about unity, I think is really important. So,
at the national conference, obviously it's not the silly stuff about clothing, right. But are there, and unity, I mean, that's, I guess, kind of what you would expect from the religious part of the world. We all got to get along, which isn't true. We don't have to. We never have, and I don't know why we think we're ever going to, but that's just my opinion, observing, you know, 10,000 years of human history. But within your organization, are there key issues, like the church itself says, we need to make sure more people eat properly in their formative years, or teenage pregnancy has to go down. Do you ever get into that kind of detail?
Oh, sure. Well, there's a lot of conversation about gun violence, obviously, in our country. Our meeting began a week after the shootings in Orlando. And so there was quite a bit of conversation about gun violence. The Presbyterian Church has also been very open to the gay and lesbian community, and has in recent years both made strong stances towards ordination of the ordination of the church being open to all individuals, and also has also stood for marriage equality before a lot of Protestant churches did that. And so those are issues. This year we had some significant elections of leadership. We do have, you know, a structure on a national level, and the moderators are moderators of a General Assembly and are elected every 2 years and manifest at the National Church Convention also. We're not all on the same page, but I think to learn to have dialogue with people you disagree with, but to still respect each other and to be able to listen to each other, again, talking about our national political environment is a really important...
Wouldn't the world be a better place?
Wouldn't that be interesting if we could disagree with each other?
I think it's possible.
And respect each other. And so I love being part of the Presbyterian Church. That's one of the main reasons.
The Presbyterian Church, you're the pastor here. How many others are in that Santa Fe footprint or region?
There are 42 congregations across northern New Mexico that are part of the Presbytery of Santa Fe. We're based in Albuquerque. The offices are at the First Presbyterian Church in Albuquerque, but we cover from Gallup all the way up to Raton, over to Aztec, back to, so it's just the northern northern part of the state.
As we talked about before we went on the air, most people in the area have heard of Placidus, but a whole bunch of people have never been here.
Right.
So how does a relatively new to this area pastor in an out-of-the-way place get elected to the national conference? I want the name of your PR firm.
The Presbytery has been very welcoming of me and of other young clergy, both male and female, who are part of the part of our local presbytery, and they asked me last year if I would consider being our commissioner this year. So I've been involved. I've part of the Presbyterian Church. We're not a congregational system, so it's not just our involvement in the life of a local congregation that's my primary responsibility.
Right.
It's understood that part of our call is to be involved in the wider church. So I've taken that call actively and have been involved.
And I guess procedurally, and I'm asking this because the Placidus Church and the Catholic Church are, I guess, really the only two houses of worship right. in Placidus. And if you're not really Catholic, that may not be where you want to go if you do want to go to a service of some kind.
Right.
So for other denominations who just, they want to do something on Sunday in that world,
right.
is... If they're not Presbyterian, are they going to go, oh my God, did you see what that man did?
I often put it this way. I tell people, if you're Catholic and want to go to church in Placitas, you go to Mission San Antonio. And if you're not Catholic and want to go to church in Placitas, you go to Las Placitas Presbyterian. So we have a wide swath of people from different backgrounds. It's very much a community church, and that, again, within the Presbyterian tradition that has kind of a big tent type of attitude about stuff that works. And so we have folks who have strong Lutheran backgrounds. I had a woman who was living in Placitas a few years ago. She says, I'm a backsliding Unitarian. Can I come here? And I was like, sure. For sometimes it's people have said, oh, what's kind of a Presby Buddhist type of group? I mean, there's some people that fit within that mindset.
I heard a new denomination a couple months ago, Jubus, because of the correlation between Buddhism and Judaism.
Sure.
Now, how would a regular Hebrew or a Jubu fare at one of your Sunday?
We have one of our members.
You have a separate room?
No. One of our members whose husband is Jewish, he regularly comes and worships at Las Placitas and is very much welcome. The doors are open. It's a place of welcome. The church has been in this community since the 1890s. And really, it was interesting. When I came here, one of the pieces when I was reading the history of the church I served in Birmingham was First Presbyterian Church in downtown Birmingham, and their pastor, Edward Ramage, was one of King's recipients, of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail.
Right.
That was the congregation I served in. And so there was a lot of history in that church about integration and segregation and welcoming. It was a historically white downtown steel baron church, and through the 1960s was really struggling with how do we welcome blacks into the life of this congregation. And they did. They opened Ed Ramage, what he's remembered of saying is at the communion table after King's letter from the Birmingham jail, he was really convicted. If you remember that letter, it begins, "My dear fellow clergymen." There were 8 clergymen in Birmingham who wrote a letter to King early on in that year saying, just let time take its course. And King said, we can't do that. Ramage was convicted, and the members of that congregation remember him standing at the communion table in 1963 saying, we welcome all whom God welcomes. Not a welcome statement to a lot of folks in Birmingham at that time. So that was the context of that congregation. When I came here, I was reading the history of Las Placitas Presbyterian Church, and it was really interesting to me in that very same time period in the 1960s, it was the Hispanics here in Placitas deciding whether to let the Anglos into the church or not. And I've often said they're still trying to decide if that was a good idea or not.
It takes time. Now, you were born in 1971?
71.
So you really weren't aware of all the racial strife that happened in your part of the country.
I didn't live through the headlines and through the newsreels that are so familiar to all of us. What I've often said, though, is that laws change faster than people do.
Oh, yeah.
And so the reality of racism was deeply embedded, obviously. No. And I think it's deeply embedded in our whole country. It's not in one region. Obviously, Selma is famous for it. And I'd lived in Memphis. Memphis obviously has that story. Right. And I pastored in Birmingham. So I've lived a lot of my life on the civil rights trail.
And I'm finding a new type of racism out here in the Great Southwest.
Right.
That I never it just never came across my radar, but it's disturbing that it exists.
back, you asked me earlier about being from Selma. One of the things that I've come to really appreciate that I didn't appreciate so much as a young person is inclusion is an incredibly important issue to me. And I want to give credit, I think, in large part from having, I didn't choose to be born where I was born, but being from Selma has had a huge impact on my life in that way. And I'm grateful for it.
Because a quieter kind of community, you know.
Because the history, you know, I don't know your experience, but I've had the opportunity to travel widely across this country and a bit internationally. And what I always say is, I've never met a person who doesn't know about my hometown. They'll ask me, where are you from? And I say, Selma. And everybody goes, oh, Selma. Everybody, you know, and this is before the most recent movie and the big 50th anniversary march and all the highlight of Selma.
Well, it's very historic. It's huge. And Civil War and, the civil rights.
So it's had a huge impact on not just my life, but I'm grateful to have that as part of my own story because it shaped the unfolding of the rest of my story.
And in not a too horrible way.
No.
In the Presbyterian service, is there any Latin?
No.
That's just strictly Catholic.
We have quite a bit of Spanish in our service here.
But not in Selma?
No, not in Selma. Okay. It's contextual to our reality here. So
I'm asking for personal reasons, because when I went to Birmingham to visit the uncle and the cousins and all that, and of course, you know, you have to go to synagogue on Friday night.
Sure.
All the prayers that are in Hebrew versus English, everybody knows it's like any other prayer. But to hear it with a Birmingham accent was quite an eye-opener.
Right.
It's like, obviously not true.
It's a different English and a different Hebrew in Birmingham, so.
Yes. Being a small community, I haven't wandered around enough in the couple of years, but I think eventually you're going to say, that kid should be in school. Hmm. Or that lady doesn't belong here, and it helps people keeping an eye on each other, which is, I don't know if that's just my fantasy world or that's kind of, it seems like a very, very tight community.
Yeah, I think I've often said, having grown up where I grew up, I understand, particularly the I don't know how familiar you are with the village culture here, but the village culture largely are families that date back to the 1700s in this place. And so there, I often say, while the cultural roots are different, I get this interrelatedness and everybody being related to everybody and the closeness of families. And I mean, I grew up in a place to be careful you talk about, because you might be related to them.
Right.
and that's true here in the village. And so there's this deep cultural root of the land grant here in Placitas. And again, those are the families that started Las Placitas Presbyterian Church. This is, you know, late 1800s. This is pre-statehood.
Right.
There's not public education. The Presbyterians came to New Mexico largely first with public education and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Presbyterian Hospital is no longer Presbyterian in terms of church, but its roots are the pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Albuquerque started the Presbyterian health system. Here in Placitas, Lavinia Thompson was the first Presbyterian in Placitas. She was a teacher from out east who had come out to teach. She was teaching in another small town in New Mexico, and the story goes that that local priest ran her out, and the folks in Placitas were looking for education for their children. There were a lot of land grabs going on. It was a time of high mining in the area, and the traditional culture realized that if they didn't have people educated in English in this new Anglo culture that was coming, and that their lands were in jeopardy, and they lost a lot of the land grants, lost a lot of land to that whole time. But Lavinia Thompson came to Placitas, and they started a mission schoolhouse and began teaching first, and then the church was established after. There was a famous Presbyterian, the first Hispanic Presbyterian minister happened to be in Bernalillo, Jose Nez Padilla, from a well-to-do Bernalillo family, and had a huge impact on the Presbyterian church in this area. I was just the other day with a Presbyterian, a retired minister from Las Vegas, New Mexico, and Perea had helped to start that congregation up in Las Vegas also. But the Gurule family and some of the long-time Placitas families invited Jose Nespereya from Bernalillo up to Placitas to talk about starting a church here in Placitas. And so in 1894, they founded Las Placitas Presbyterian Church with 30-something, you know, families from
And they were living in the villages?
Sure. Well, in that time, the village had moved from where it used to be here a bit, let's see, to the north, to currently where the village is. It was there. The church has been in that same space in the village. The mission schoolhouse was there first. They remodeled that mission schoolhouse, and then in the 1930s, they took that building down and literally took the adobes out of the walls of the old mission schoolhouse and put them into the original sanctuary that's still part of the church building today, the 1930s sanctuary.
Right.
And then, that was the church until the 1980s, and then it grew. So,
can it grow anymore?
I think it can. I don't know that we're all that interested, at least currently, in talking about a larger physical plant. We've got a great facility that serves both the church and the community well. The church has grown quite a bit. When I came in 2011, we were averaging about 80 people in worship on a Sunday, and there are about 120 in worship now. So it's grown pretty significantly. And there's
about 180 is kind of max?
Well, oftentimes, churches today, I think there's an opportunity for different, we're actually looking at some different types of worship experiences, and so there's chances for churches to make space for other people without expanding the physical plant, using different styles and times for worship, and so.
So right now, your services start at what time?
Right now in the summer at 9:30, we have a single service in the summer at 9:30, and then during the September through May season, during the school season, if you think about it that way, we have two services, an 8:30 early service that meets in the original sanctuary, it's called the upper room now, and then at 10:30, we have a full service with choir, and so.
Is it just a complete repeat other than the choir?
No, they're two very different services. The early service is more conversational and contemplative. We use a few common elements. I like to do that so that there's some common worship that we're having across the worship experiences on a Sunday, but they're different types of services.
And within the Presbyterian faith, are you expected to have a sermon each week, and do you follow the New Testament in any kind of order for what your sermon's about? Or
we have my ministry is called a ministry of word and sacrament, so the word piece is very important, the spoken word, the read word. We use both the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament scriptures. There's a lectionary cycle that's a cycle of readings. We're not bound to that. And the some liturgical traditions are prescriptive in how they must be followed, and ours is more descriptive. It is a guideline, but we're not limited by it. So there may be, we can use the lectionary, but we're not obligated to. We're a liturgical church, so we use a lot of the traditions, but
could you use any of the books of the New Testament that weren't canonized?
Sure, if you chose to. Yeah.
Okay. Is I guess part of what I'm getting at is, you know, I think this is a true statement. If I go to Sunday Mass at the Santa Fe Catholic Church or the one in Dallas, Texas, I'm not going to be lost. I'm going to know what's going on. Is that true in the Presbyterian Church?
I would think so. Yes, you'll have there's more variety. My experience of Catholic churches is there's quite a bit of variety also. I think people, there, you know, you have more high church traditions, more low church traditions, more charismatic type of traditions. You have folk revival type of movement traditions. I mean, there's, even within the Catholic Church, there's that breadth.
Right.
The Presbyterian Church would have a similar flavor across different places, but each congregation has its own reality. For example, the Spanish piece that we use here, it's more of a heritage piece. I say each Sunday, I know that we weren't all born speaking Spanish,
right,
but this congregation was.
Right.
So lean into it with your best Spanish ability is my invitation on a weekly basis.
And do you, with all your intense study in Argentina, do you think in Spanish or in English? Or
both.
What language do you dream in?
Both.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I'm in Argentina,
In the dream?
I've done some work in Mexico, if I'm in a context where I'm predominantly in a Spanish context, I do a lot more thinking and dreaming in Spanish. And my world here is predominantly English. Spanish is a piece of it, but not a dominant sure. piece.
So as the pastor of the Presbyterian Church here in Placitas, are you a manager? Are you an employee? Who do you work for? Who signs the paycheck?
Well, the paycheck is from the local congregation, but this connectional system I spoke about earlier,
right.
It's really a four-way call, is the understanding in the Presbyterian Church tradition. The local congregation extends the call. It has to be approved by the presbytery, so the presbytery of Santa Fe approved the call. We believe that God is the body behind moving the call, and then obviously the pastor who accepts the call. It's accepted by all three bodies: the congregation, the presbytery, and the person called to serve. So.
Okay. So we were speaking about kind of the business side of this particular church, and no matter how you want to avoid it, it's still in some way a business. It's got to pay the electric bill and sure. all of that. So there's an elementary school that's part of it.
We have a cooperative child daycare program for children. It's a preschool program.
Okay.
It's called
and state sanctioned or whatever.
It's a yeah. It's 30. I think almost 30 years old now. They've been doing this. There were no childcare options in Placitas, and so they started at that time. It's still called Mother's Day Out. Though I often tell them, I said I fathered my children a lot too, so it's not just for mothers.
Right.
But it's provided a much-needed service that the church began, again, almost 30 years ago.
So it's daycare?
It's child care, preschool okay. daycare.
And who is it open to? Children?
It's open to children, and most of the parents, obviously because of the location, come from the Placitas community. Though we end up having a few families from Bernalillo or Rio Rancho who like the style and the feel of the program.
Okay, and you have openings.
Yes, and it's a great. Debbie Stuber has been the director of that program for over 25 years now, and she's an incredible leader of that program. And so there's mm-hmm. If you talk to families in Placitas, you'll run across a lot whose kids are now college age, but went through. Oftentimes they're referred to as Miss Debbie's.
Okay.
So the Mother's Day Out's been an important part of the community. So.
Sure. And also, I mean, there is the Placitas Artist Series is hosted there.
Right.
There all kinds of things. Who oversees coordination of all that? Because any event takes a lot of work.
Right. Well, it's under the jurisdiction of the church session. The session is the governing body of the church, but we have a really effective church administrator, Delfina Hernandez.
She's a nice person.
She's incredible. And she runs the administrative part of the church. So she does a lot of the coordinating and scheduling, and she and I work together on issues. And again, the church has this ethos of being a center for the community. So, we were often a polling place. We were just early polling for Sandoval County for a couple of weeks last month. A lot of homeowners associations meet in the church. For a long time, before this library was here and before the
right.
senior center was here, the church has been here, and it's still one of the largest gathering spaces in the community. And so the church is...
And one of the prettiest.
Thank you. I think it is beautiful. The church has understood that it's part of its role to really be an integral part of the community. And so a lot of community forums, if there are, often say, I'd like for us to host contentious issue forums because doing that in the sanctuary actually creates an environment that people listen to each other.
Right. And is Casa Rosa a separate entity?
Casa Rosa started from the church. It's still underneath the umbrella of the church. It's on church property. It has a community board, which is an excellent involvement of people across all swaths of life in Plessy. That's often say Casa Rosa. I think the food support it gives to the weekly food pantry is critical. One of the biggest gifts to the Placitas community, in addition to the food pantry that that Casa Rosa offers is a community gathering space. So you have people who, across all ends of the socioeconomic spectrum, across all of the cultural spectrums, folks who are community volunteers and may serve on the board or a regular. There's an amazing group of volunteers who every week are unloading trucks of food from the Roadrunner Food Pantry. When we started that ministry, that started before I came here.
Right.
A lot of folks said, Placitas doesn't need a food pantry. People see, they look from I-25 up.
Certainly.
And they see the houses that are along 165 coming up, but they don't see the poverty that's in Placitas, and there's a great deal of it. And so it's a real community effort. The Placitas Artist Series celebrates its 30th anniversary season next year.
So yes.
For 30 years, they've been doing concerts and visual arts and have been a huge piece. So that's, again, the congregation senses that.
That sure is unique to be up here and to get that kind of world-class entertainment.
It's incredible.
It's like those restaurants saying, you know, we're selling hamburgers at $19.10 prices, you know. The ticket prices are so ancient.
And you have Grammy award-winning guitarists playing in the sanctuary. Part of that happened when they built the sanctuary, the larger sanctuary in 1985. A piece that they found when it was built is the acoustics were incredible. And we often have artists, you'll say, can I come back here and record? because it really does have an acoustic sweet spot in that sanctuary. So it's a wonderful space for live music.
Is any of the meeting halls or the sanctuary itself, is it available for hire? Like if with my homeowners, or I want to have a quinceanero or something? Or
certain things we do. We have a lot of homeowners. We do all types of different events. So we don't... We have a schedule of fees that we ask just to help cover our costs, but it's not an event hall for hire, if you will, in a sense of for profit. It's not a profit making in for the church. We ask people to help us cover the expenses because obviously there are costs involved.
Right.
But it's community participation is the way I look at it.
You're not competing with Isotope Park or the Pit or anything. but if a nonprofit needed a place to do some kind of fundraiser.
We'll have Albuquerque churches who are looking for a place for a leadership retreat, and this is close, but they really get away coming up to Placitas, and so, there are lots of different events that take place, or for music recitals to different gatherings.
And the church is solvent. We don't have to worry. We don't have to have a fund drive, anything like that.
No, when I came here, I came in 2011 after 2008. The church had gone through really tough economic times, and I'd done quite a bit of work in faith and money in our lives as Christians, and what does it look like? How do we relate to finances in our lives? I think it's an important question as people of faith, whatever our faith tradition be, and so I've actually worked with the congregation a lot to bring it back around financially. When I came here, they actually said, so here's the deal. We have enough money in reserves that we can pay you for 2 years, but if we can't turn this around, that's all we can do.
Okay.
God has a sense of humor, and we came out here.
They led with their strong suit, huh?
Right. But but what I've said all along is while there are people who live in poverty in our community, we're not a poor community.
Certainly not.
Sometimes I feel like Placitas, we like to downplay the capacity of our resources, and we make it that we're not a community with a wealth of resources. And I have not seen that to be the case. There are people who live very much on the margins and on the edge and need all kinds of support. Many of those families have an incredible wealth of family networks. What I've seen, too, there are people here who have a lot of economic resources but find themselves alone in times of need.
Yes.
And so there's a disparity in that sense.
But if you work the system, and I hope I'm not ready for that for a long time, but when I get to that point, if it still exists, you know, the community center and all the people that are there,
our senior center is excellent.
What a great place for emotional support.
Sure. Well, one of the things I've said, I think one of our greatest gifts and one of our greatest challenges in Placitas is the amount of space that we have. Many of us move here because we like the expansiveness and the openness and not being on top of your neighbors and having that just space. One of the challenges of that is that also, I've often said, I think we attract an unusually high number of people who don't play well with others. We come here because of the space. We mm-hmm. like to be isolated.
But the people that I found who don't play well with others don't want to play.
Right.
So that go off and do what you want. Just leave
right.
me out of it.
Right.
I want to talk just a little bit, if there are some tangible examples you can give me. The church was not doing exceptionally well.
Right.
You came in. Were there things that you can look back on now, Drew, and say, okay, because we did this, this, and this, now we're in good shape for the next 10 years?
Sure. We had a significant mortgage debt from a building expansion that we needed to have done that was done in 2005. And when I came in here, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was between $300,000 and $400,000 that the church had on a building debt. And we're not a huge congregation, and
right.
It was not insignificant, but also said, you know, there are plenty of individuals who have that level of mortgage on their homes in Placitas. Not everyone, but
right.
there are plenty that do. And so,
and higher.
Yes. and so I really started working with the church after being here about 6 months, just identified that it was going to be critical for us as we move forward to pay off that building expansion debt. And so we began working in my first year here to achieve that. And we did a couple of years ago. So we're debt free.
And I would, that's amazing. Can I have their names? I would have suspected that you also had financial help from people who were not necessarily members.
We had a little bit. I think one of the things as we move into the future, we're solvent now. I would really love to see us. I think that church serves. We've been talking about this, such a critical role for the Placitas community. I would really love to see the care of that building insured into the future. I know congregations that will build an endowment, for example, for a church building to cover, just because there are expenses of keeping the building. And what I see that doing in the future is freeing the congregation and the community to spend their resources on the ministry and the mission they're called to do. And I would love to pass forward the gift to the future of that congregation, not have to worry about the building.
What a great gift.
Yeah. So there's things we can still do.
Top two things you want to accomplish in the next year?
Good question. I'll start on a personal level, but this is related to the congregation. This in my seventh year. Next year, I have an opportunity to take a sabbatical. And I was talking about music earlier. We were working with the congregation, looking at the song lines of our lives, mm-hmm. And what role music has played in the life of this congregation. Obviously, with the 30th anniversary of the artist series, and with the role that music plays in the worship life of a congregation. But I have a fiddle that belonged to my paternal grandfather that I've been learning to play. And so the congregation has given me the support to go spend next summer really pursuing my love for music.
So when did you start playing then?
3 years ago. I've been taking lessons from a Celtic fiddler in Albuquerque. And I have a long way to go. It's a hard instrument to learn, but I love bluegrass and old time and folk type of music, and again studying Celtic fiddling right now.
Selma, Alabama. Yeah. Here we
I
go.
I come from the Appalachians. Yeah. So,
The Manol School. You're the chairman of the. It's a private Christian school.
It's a Presbyterian school that started also in the 1890s in Albuquerque. James Manol was. They were Scotch Irish missionaries who were here in Albuquerque, and he helped start Las Placitas Presbyterian Church. And so several years ago, I was asked to, our oldest son, Santiago, has just finished middle school at Manol. Manol School was a secondary education school that many of the schools like Las Placitas would have sent had primary education here, but across the small villages of northern New Mexico, there weren't opportunities for secondary education. So the Presbyterians started schools across northern New Mexico, primary education, and then they would send students to the Manal School in Albuquerque. So there was a long boarding school tradition of northern New Mexican students that is a very small part of the school now. The boarding program actually closed for a few years, but now they reopened in the last 5 to 10 years, and there are almost 40 international students from 16 different countries who are part of that community, as well as Native American, Hispanic, Anglo, like much of the culture in New Mexico. It is a Presbyterian school. I think you've gotten a little bit of the ethos of the Presbyterian Church
sure.
in our conversation, so it's not... And it's not trying to put anybody's faith in a box, is the way I'd like to think right. about it, but it encourages spiritual development as part of the life of the students. And so as a parent and a pastor in the presbytery, it's part of our Presbyterian system. I felt it was important to give back to the school. So when they asked me to serve as the chair of the board, I said, I'd be glad to do that. So
how long is the term?
I committed to at least 2 years, okay. and I just started in May.
Okay. So. Is Manal Spanish?
No, it was there was a Scotch Irish family, but the Manal Boulevard in Albuquerque
right.
Was named because of the Manal School.
Because one of my uncles' given name is Manal, perhaps spelled differently,
right?
But it was it meant Moses.
So
I don't think he was Scotch Irish.
Maybe not.
Yeah, he was Hungarian. But. Let's go south of the border, or is it east of the border? Argentina.
Okay.
Can you tango?
I cannot tango.
Did you ever try?
I tried once.
Okay. And
I learned that was not my gift.
Okay.
It's beautiful.
It doesn't look like a fun dance to dance. It looks like a fun dance to watch, like flamenco. I love to watch it.
Right.
Would want to do it.
Right. Right.
But.
It's a very passionate dance. It started as a dance between the gauchos, the equivalent of the cowboys in Argentina.
Right.
And it was actually, it was a competitive, almost a warring type of dance. And so you can see, it has a really deep and interesting history. And the tango music is, the Argentines are very, have a melancholic streak to them, and you hear that in the tango music.
Right. Well, it's been such a tumultuous government. And
sure.
Is it true what they say about Argentinian beef?
It's incredible.
Really? You can really, really tell.
Well, the pampas in Argentina is a huge grassy area, so... here, you know, you'd hear people talking about, well, free-range cattle.
Right.
That was all there was in Argentina. So,
no.
The red wine is good too.
Yes, it is. How old were your boys when you moved to Placitas?
Let's see. Santiago was 10, and Francisco, who we call Paco, would have been 5, 6.
Okay. Six. So the 10-year-old was Argentinian.
He came from Birmingham, so they're both
okay.
From
so they're not like freaking out.
No. No, they're both from Alabama.
And so what are they, the geography is totally different. They've
loved it. Santiago, you know, kids have such an incredible perception in our first year here. And I would check in with them. It was a big move for them. It was a big move for all of us. And I asked him, I said, you know, just check in, how are you doing? And he said, you know what, the expansiveness of the views here, he said, I feel more free.
I know what he means, because
I do too.
You know, coming from the Northeast, the first year we were here, we drove from Placitas to Las Vegas, Nevada.
Right.
It's only about an inch on the map. It's a big country.
It's huge.
It's a big, big country.
Right.
And, you know, I've flown it dozens of times, and you go, okay, it's an extra hour and a half. But when you're on that road bouncing around, you really feel it. It was almost patriotic in a way. But.
And obviously, being from a Latin American and the southeast United States, and being a blended family, there's pieces we've really enjoyed about being out here, being in a culture where the Hispanic part of this culture is much more prominent, obviously, than in the southeast, and with names like Santiago and Francisco.
Right.
This is part of their heritage. So.
Sure. Perfect.
Yeah.
Your wife is a career woman.
Right.
And she's in the medical field?
She does community health care has always been her call, and she's a family practice physician and works in community health. So she works in a nonprofit health care.
And down in El Pueblo?
Well, she was at El Pueblo. She began working at El Pueblo, and after our oldest son went to Manal School, after a year of running that road back and forth, both morning and afternoon,
right.
She decided to take a job in town. So she works for First Choice Community Health, which is based out of the South Valley,
mm-hmm.
And she works in a North Valley clinic, a similar type of clinic as El Pueblo.
They're all part of that same federal program?
They're different programs. In fact, First Choice probably, you know, El Pueblo is the only clinic up here sees a pretty wide swath of folks across the community.
Right.
Obviously, in Albuquerque, there's more healthcare choices than we have up here in Placitas and Bernalillo. So actually, they tend to see more of the underserved population at First Choice, predominantly more so than she right. saw up here. So,
well, but she's enjoying working here as
oh, yeah.
well as raising a family here.
Sure, sure. So being we were assured early on, and it's proved to be true, that being a bilingual family practice physician who's committed to serving in community health, it wasn't going to be hard for her to find work in New Mexico. And that's been true.
Works well. So. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry she's not out here in El Pueblo, which is closer to
right.
myself.
She enjoyed serving up here, and it was great, just for family reasons, and spending less time on the highway made a lot more sense.
So. Absolutely. Not right. one of my favorite things.
Right.
Have we forgotten anything? Anything that you would like to say? Anything I could have possibly overlooked?
I'm okay.
Okay.
We went wide and far, I know, so.
Good. Well, this has been Conversations with Matthew Bronson here in Placitas, New Mexico on KUPR 99.9 FM. And today's conversation has been with Drew Henry. Amongst many other things, he is the pastor at the Placitas Presbyterian Church. Check out a Sunday. I think I'm going to. I've been convinced it would be a nice experience. So again, for a conversation with Matthew Bronson, KUPR 99.9, thank you. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you very much.